Welcome to DAC Beechcroft's Lawcast. My name is Lisa Geary, and I am joined today by Victoria Armstrong. We are both partners in DAC Beechcroft's real estate healthcare team. This edition of our podcast series focuses on primary care leases, why and when they are needed, and key terms to consider. So to start, Victoria, I thought it'd be a good idea to go right back to basics. So my first question is, what is a lease?
That's a really good place to start. So a lease is an arrangement put in place to formalise the relationship between the owner of a property, the landlord, and another person who occupies that property with exclusive possession, the tenant. A person has exclusive possession if it can exercise the rights of the landowner and exclude both the landlord and third parties from the land, say for any rights reserved to the landlord, for example, to enter and inspect the property. A lease will usually be for a fixed term and the tenant will pay a rent. The document will set out obligations of both parties, so any specific rights granted to the tenant, such as rights of access over common parts or to use communal facilities, any rights reserved for the benefit of the landlord, such as rights to enter to carry out works or to inspect the property, and a lease will also include any restrictions on the tenant's use of the property.
Thank you, that's really helpful. So in that case, should a lease be put in place in every instance of occupation?
Well, it's important on a number of fronts. Many practices are still occupying their surgery premises without a formal agreement in place, and there's been a move over recent years from NHS England to encourage practices to regularise this position by entering into a formal lease. Having a formal lease will ensure that a practice knows the extent of the space that they occupy, which services are to be provided by the landlord, key finances connected to that occupation, and also their obligations in relation to the property. And this should reduce the potential for disputes with the landlord and provide the practice with a clear mechanism for ensuring that the landlord complies with its obligations in respect of the property and occupation. And this also provides security to GP tenants that they can deliver their contracted services from their surgery premises and gives them a mechanism to ensure that their surgery premises remain compliant from a patient safety perspective. The rent reimbursement regime is governed by the premises cost directions, and under those directions, a GP practice must prove their tenancy represents good value for money in order to secure continued rent reimbursement. A lease provides evidence of this value for money assessment and can therefore aid practices in their claims for rent reimbursement. Additionally, where improvements are needed to surgery premises, any application under the directions for an improvement grant will need to include evidence that the practice has adequate security of tenure in respect of the property, and a formal lease will provide the best evidence of that security.
Thanks, Victoria. It sounds really important to make sure you have a lease in place where you need it. So where you perhaps don't need a lease, what might the alternatives be?
Well, a practice may be presented with a licence to occupy in relation to its surgery premises. And I think we need to be very wary of licence arrangements on the whole. A licence is a personal agreement that entitles the occupier, the licensee, to use the property. They're generally shorter term arrangements, and an occupier will usually not have the same degree of control over the property as it would under a lease. A licence doesn't confer any security of tenure on the licensee, and it also doesn't create a property interest, and so it can't be assigned or transferred to a successor, such as a new GP partner. And in most cases, it can't be enforced against a purchaser of the landlord's interest in the property. And there may be some circumstances where a license will be appropriate, such as where the practice shares use of a room on a sessional basis. However, where a practice is looking to formalise its exclusive occupation of a surgery premises, a license isn't appropriate. And even if one is granted, it could still be construed to be a lease. So, Lisa, I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about when a lease is needed for primary care premises in particular.
Yes, there's quite a sort of specific regime here. Under the premises cost directions, a contractor must have a property interest to be able to get premises cost reimbursement. So where the property is owned by any party which is not a contractor, in most situations, there are a couple of very limited exceptions. A lease must be put in place. Examples of the ownership of primary care premises are very often, it's very often the case that they're owned by either investors, NHS trusts, NHS property services, community health partnerships, retired partners, or a combination of retired partners and current partners, and possibly where practices incorporate under OpCo, PropCo models. So an example would be A, B, C and D own the property from which the primary care services are delivered. A and B have retired, but they've kept a property interest. And the current partners who are contracted to provide the services are C, D and E. D and E not having a property interest and C having a property interest. In this case, a lease must be put in place between A, B, C and D as the property owners and C, D and E as the contractors. If a lease isn't put in place, where there should be, then the premises cost reimbursement for the practice is at risk.
Thanks, Lisa. Could you explain briefly a bit more about the premises reimbursement regime?
Well, the current version of premises cost directions was issued in 2013. It sets out the basis on which NHS England or the ICB through delegated authority can provide funding to GP contractors for their revenue and capital costs incurred in relation to the property from where they deliver their NHS contracted services. Notional or borrowing cost rent is paid to owner contractors and lease cost rent is paid to a contracting practice where a lease is needed. So another example, A, B, and C own the property and A, B and C are the contractors. So in this case, the application will be for reimbursement on a notional or borrowing cost rent basis. A and B retire, keeping their property interest, and D and E join the practice. So C, D and E are now the contractors and therefore a lease is needed. And what will happen then is that the practice will be reimbursed on a lease cost rent basis under an ICB approved lease. And coming on to approval, any lease needs to be approved by the ICB before it is granted to protect any rights to claim lease cost reimbursement. The district valuer will undertake a value for money report to confirm the current market rental which the ICB can reimburse. Now, the ICB will have particular requirements for provisions in the lease to comply with value for money directions and to protect the public purse. A really important point to check at the outset is whether an ICB is expecting to see a full repairing and insuring lease or a tenant internal repairing lease, and more of that later.
So a lease will clearly give a practice more security and certainty. Are there any issues that a practice as tenant will need to be aware of when negotiating a lease?
Well, all negotiations should start with a robust set of heads of terms. These will be non-binding, but will set out the main commercial aspects of the proposed lease. They reflect the commercial deal agreed between the parties at the outset and will enable both parties to decide whether to enter into the lease. While they're not legally binding, departures from agreed sets of heads of terms is largely frowned upon, and therefore it's really important to take legal advice at an early stage to ensure that all potential issues are identified and, importantly, GP-specific provisions are included. They should not look like a set of purely commercial heads of terms. If they don't include that specific GP detail, this could lead to protracted negotiations in respect to the lease itself, prejudice being able to get ICB's consent, and ultimately lead to delay and increased costs for all parties.
Yeah, and a good starting point when considering the lease provisions will be the term. As you've said, this is the length of the lease arrangement and the period during which the practice will be bound by the lease provisions. And in our experience, practices have been reluctant to be bound by a longer term lease because of ongoing changes and uncertainty within the primary care sector. Is there anything that we need to bear in mind here?
a really good question, and one which I think can lead to quite a lot of debate at the outset of trying to negotiate lease terms. As we've mentioned, the term will be the period of time for which the lease is granted, and how long the term of the lease should be is really a matter of negotiation between the parties, but there will be other drivers. We have seen a trend over recent years of reluctance within GP practices to enter into longer term leases. Very often GP practices might ideally like to have a 5-year lease because of fears of committing to a particular property. And that could be as a result of the ongoing flux in the primary care sector and uncertainty about what primary care provision will look like in years to come, and also some reluctance on some of the more junior GPs joining to perhaps commit to a practice for a long period of time. However, the ICB will have the final say on the length of term it is prepared to fund. The length of term affects the value of the rent, usually a shorter lease commands a higher rent, and so the ICB needs to ensure that the agreed term reflects how long that premises is likely to be needed by the practice. 15 years is usually the starting point where the primary care provision from the property is stable, but it may be less if there's a likelihood of an ICB-supported move to new premises, or where there has been capital investment requiring a longer term by a third-party developer. Ultimately, there just needs to be a sensible approach in agreeing an appropriate length of term, taking account of the particular circumstances. Often landlords will be unwilling to grant a short-term lease because a longer term can support the value of their freehold and provide financial security, for example, on sale and leasebacks, where investors will require at least a 15-year term and sometimes 20 or 25 years. This can leave practices in a difficult position, but there are ways in which we can strike a balance here, allowing practices to enter longer-term arrangements, but ensuring they have flexibility to reflect future changes in the practice and the NHS generally. Good, robust assignment provisions can help as a minimum. As a minimum, we'd usually look to include a break right for GP tenants, allowing the practice to break their lease if they lose their core contract. If a practice loses its core contract, it will lose the right to reclaim reimbursement, whether through voluntarily serving notice to terminate or otherwise. This is often referred to as an Armageddon provision. The forms of what is called an Armageddon clause vary, and what is agreed will depend on the negotiating strengths and also the identity of the landlord. A very tenant-friendly position would be where the core contract ends for whatever reason, including a voluntary handback, but this may not be commercially acceptable to some landlords, in particular investors, and may need to be reduced to where the core contract ends other than by the act or default of the tenant. There may also be scope to include additional fixed date breaks, which would allow a practice to terminate the lease on serving specified notice at a particular point. These break clauses come in different guises, and given their key importance to practices, it is important that advice is taken at an early stage in relation to any break right. There can, however, be issues with them being approved by the ICB, as they often uplift the rental value, and they won't be approved if they are simply a nice to have when they aren't in reality needed. So, Victoria, coming on to rent. Rent is quite a tricky area for GP practices because of the rent reimbursement regime and its complexities. We would always advise our GP clients to seek advice at the outset from a specialist surveyor with experience in dealing with GP premises in order to discuss the likely rental value before agreeing this with the landlord. Can you explain why this is so important?
Yeah, the rent proposed by a landlord might not reflect what a practice will be reimbursed by the ICB. It's important that a practice ensures the sums payable under the lease reflect reimbursement in order to avoid shortfalls in the rent, which would need to be covered by practice income. It's really important that a practice applies to the ICB for financial assistance towards their rent under the premises cost directions before they agree the lease. The ICB will review the proposed lease in order to determine whether they can issue a value for money report to the practice. That report will usually confirm acceptance of the proposed lease. However, it may also suggest variations that would make the lease acceptable to the ICB. And without acceptance or approval from the ICB, a practice will not receive reimbursement for rent payable under the lease. The ICB will work with the district valuer in reviewing the proposed lease, and they will be particularly interested in the level of rent. If they think that the rent appears to be excessive, the ICB and the district valuer will suggest an alternative amount of rent. And that can cause problems when facing a commercial landlord who might be looking for a market rent. These are therefore really important discussions to have with the landlord at the outset with support from a specialist surveyor. Another consideration here will be VAT. Some landlords may have elected to charge VAT on the rent payable by the practice. And unless this VAT element is accepted by the ICB and included within reimbursement, the practice would need to cover this element out of practice income. It's therefore important to check the VAT position at the outset. And this can be a tricky area. Often VAT isn't payable at the grant of the lease, but may become payable after the grant of the lease. And specialist legal advice will help practices to ensure that they have protection in the lease against having to pay any VAT, which is not reimbursed by the ICB.
Great. Thanks, Victoria. And I think we've both had the experience that the most successful lease negotiations are where the ICB and the landlord and the tenant and their respective advisors are all working together at the outset to get on the same page. And rent's really important because that also links in with rent review. Perhaps you could sort of tell us a little bit more about rent review.
Yeah, so the lease will set out rent review provisions, which include the timings and mechanism for the review of annual rent throughout the term of the lease. And ordinarily, reviews are done in comparison to changes in the rental market or by a defined index, such as the retail price index. Reviews are often stated to be upwards only, meaning the rent will never decrease throughout the term of the lease. But for a GP practice, the rent review provisions will be reviewed by the ICB as part of the overall lease approval process. And rent reviews for reimbursement purposes follow a three-yearly pattern. It's important that the level of rent reimbursement paid to the practice is reviewed alongside the rent review. Under the premises cost directions, when the rent is to be reviewed, practices are required to provide the ICB with a rent review memorandum signed by both parties to document the agreed revised rent. And practices may look to agree the revised rent with the landlord themselves before sending the memorandum to the ICB, but we would recommend that advice from a specialist surveyor is obtained in respect of those discussions beforehand. The lease should include a provision stating that the revised rent on review must track reimbursement, and that's really imperative for GP practices, actually. If it doesn't, there is the potential for a shortfall between the rent payable under the lease and the sum reimbursed to the practice, and that would be the practice's personal responsibility. So revised rent must always reflect what a practice is entitled to in terms of reimbursement. A common agreed position is an upwards or downwards review to track the reimbursed rent, but not falling below the initial rent. But I think the main point here is that it is really important that the rent review provisions in a GP lease have specialist legal input to protect the practice from having to pay more rent than that which will be reimbursed to the practice. Lisa, we know a lot of primary care premises nationally are suffering from backlog maintenance issues, but a lease would ordinarily place repairing obligations on a tenant for the property. What are the key considerations from a GP tenant perspective in agreeing the repairing terms of a lease?
So I think it's important to just outline the difference between what we call a full repairing and insuring lease, an FRI, and a tenant internal repairing lease in the context of GP premises. So there are two common repairing positions in GP leases, the FRI and the TIR, and the differences will affect both the repairing and the service charge provisions, which we're going to discuss in a moment. Currently, many ICBs are leaning towards TIR leases, and what the ICB expects should be checked at the outset, because that's going to affect your lease negotiations. FRI leases are still approved, particularly on renewals or regears where the previous lease was an FRI. So it's a really important initial discussion to have. So let's talk about what FRI is. So you can have an FRI lease of whole or part, and the tenant is either responsible for all repairs to the building, so the whole of the building, including the structure and the exterior, and it will pay to the landlord the insurance premium that the landlord incurs for insuring the building. Or it could be an FRI lease of the internal part or a part, in which case the tenant does the internal repairs, but the costs of the landlord for repairing the structure and the exterior and replacing plant and insuring the building will be recovered as part of a separate service charge. So the landlord retains responsibility, but the tenant pays. Now, the uplift that the ICB applied to the current market rental to cover the costs incurred by the practice relating to the structure and the external repair and a few other items and insurance is around 5-7%. And that will be retained by the practice in an FRI lease situation and used towards the actual cost of or the element of the service charge relating to those items. So any shortfall in that case is a practice cost. If you look at the TIR situation, the tenant internal repairing situation, again, that can be of whole or part. If it's a lease of whole on a TIR basis, the tenant pays the rent to the landlord, which includes the uplift, and the landlord has a responsibility for the structure and exterior and insurance cost and does not charge extra for this. Those services are rent inclusive. If it's a TIR lease of part, the same applies, and there will be a separate service charge relating to other services like security, landscaping, heating, and lighting of common parts, all of which will be a practice cost. The risk of the cost overrun beyond the uplift for the structural and external repairs that the landlord receives from the tenant through the rent will therefore sit with the landlord. So as you'll see, it's a complex area. And so advice on FRI and TIR and what can be a rent inclusive service for TIR is really important. So Victoria, can you tell us a little bit more about the standard of repair and other general pointers once a practice has worked out whether or not it's going to be taking an FRI or a TIR lease?
Well, the standard of repair required by the specific repairing obligations would be set out in the lease, and they're really important. A tenant will usually have a covenant to keep the premises in repair, and that covenant would include an obligation to put the premises into repair if they're already in disrepair at the start of the lease. So a practice should inspect the premises for existing disrepair before it takes the lease. It should also assess the potential costs of that repair. A practice might wish to limit its repairing obligation to the same state of the premises as at the time the lease was entered into. And this would limit the practice's liability for any pre-existing wants of repair. We would append a schedule of condition to the lease in that case, and that is essentially a schedule containing photographic evidence of the condition of the premises as at the date of the lease. Where there are pre-existing wants of repair and a schedule of condition is attached to the lease, it might be necessary to agree a snagging list with the landlord containing items that the landlord has agreed to rectify at its cost. Depending on the nature of those snagging list items, this could help ensure the premises remains compliant from a patient safety perspective. Additionally, where there have been recent works carried out by the landlord at a premises or where the premises are newly built, for instance, the practice may want to consider excluding liability for any inherent defects from its repairing obligation. An inherent defect is one that is due to a defect in the design or construction of a building or the materials used in those works, which was existing when the works were completed but was not apparent at that stage. And unless liability for inherent defects is excluded, a tenant would be liable to repair any damage caused by that inherent defect. And alongside that exclusion, we would recommend that an obligation is included for the landlord to rectify any damage caused by an inherent defect. We wouldn't expect much pushback on that generally from a landlord, as they should have the benefit of warranties from the designers and contractors who carried out the work. All of this should be considered by a practice at the outset at heads of terms stage.
Thank you. And so often, as we've mentioned, a practice will occupy a multi-let building, such as a community health centre, and increasingly, for example, the move towards health hubs. In that case, it's usual for the landlord to, as we've mentioned, repair and maintain the structure, common parts and exterior of the health centre. And they will look, as we've mentioned, to pass these costs down to the tenants by way of a service charge for an FRI lease of part. And in both FRI and TIR leases, they would look to pass down the costs of other services provided, as previously mentioned. So there has been a lot of discussion around service charge and a lot of time given to talking about how to control service charges in the press recently too. Can you explain how they usually work and what practices need to be aware of?
Yeah, so service charge provisions ordinarily will set out the services to be provided by the landlord, the tenant's proportion of the costs of the provision of those services, and the mechanism for calculating the tenant's costs. Where applicable, a cap on the charges to the tenant, when and how service charges are to be paid, and how disputes in relation to service charge will be resolved. And as you say, service charges have been a hot topic for a long time now, and lots of practices have faced hugely increased costs in respect of their existing premises in certain circumstances. In order to avoid those issues, it's important that a lease makes it clear that service charges must be reasonably and properly incurred by the landlord, and that provision of services and invoicing are transparent. There are items that we would look to exclude from the service charge, which the practice should not be expected to contribute towards, such as damage by an inherent defect where relevant, costs attributable solely to another occupier of the building, potentially. And this should be set out clearly within the lease and cross-checked against the service charge breakdowns received from the landlord where there is any doubt on the part of the practice in terms of the costs being charged to them. It's essential in circumstances where the practice holds a TIR lease and the reimbursement figure received by the practice includes an uplift for the practice's costs towards structural and external repairs and insurance, that appropriate provision is made in the lease to exclude costs relating to structural and external repairs and insurance from the service charge. And that would avoid the potential for double counting of those costs. Future-proofing is at the forefront of considerations for most practices, and this often has an impact on the decision to take a lease and the length of the term. Are we able to help future-proof a lease of surgery premises to accommodate changes in the partnership?
Yes, primarily we'll be looking at the alienation provisions in a lease. These deal with the tenant's ability to assign or transfer the lease, to underlet, or to share occupation of the premises. In the absence of any express restrictions, a lease is freely assignable. However, most leases will contain restrictions on the tenant's ability to assign and give the landlord control over the terms of any assignment and the identity and covenant strength of the assignee. So usually a lease will allow a tenant to assign the whole of the lease with the landlord's consent, generally not to be unreasonably withheld. Assignments of part are ordinarily prohibited. A landlord's consent can be subject to certain conditions which must be satisfied by the tenant before the assignment can proceed, such as provision of a guarantor or the tenant guaranteeing the assignee's performance of the tenant obligations under the lease. And the same applies to underlettings. A lease would usually restrict underlettings of part, possibly depending on the footprint of the property or the number of these at any one time, so that the landlord can preserve control. But generally, underlettings of whole, subject to landlord's consent, not to be unreasonably withheld, may be allowed subject to conditions. You may find with primary care leases, however, that landlords can be reluctant to allow underletting of whole because on the basis that the whole isn't required anymore, you're usually looking at an assignment to a new primary care services provider. Additionally, a lease will normally restrict the tenant's ability to share occupation of the premises too. So practices should seek to negotiate some flexibility in the assignment and sharing provisions. They should be looking to include a provision allowing them to assign to incoming partners of the practice without the need to seek landlord's consent, and also deal with some retiring partners perhaps exiting at the same time. This is to allow really the particular provisions in the lease which will deal with the ability for a partnership to deal with its succession planning. A practice might also want the ability to assign the lease to an NHS body or another contracted entity, for example, an incorporated practice, without the landlord's consent. As we all know, partnerships are fluid and the practice can see a number of changes over a short space of time, retirement of partner, admission of new partners. And basically, the practice does not want to be obliged to request landlord's consent in respect of each of those changes because it will cause delays and there will be additional legal costs of the landlord involved in the giving of consent. And those costs would normally be borne by the practice and the consent formally documented in a licence to assign. So having the freedom to go ahead and deal with those changes without landlord's consent will free the practice of additional admin and also costs. In addition, a practice should look to include a provision that would allow them to share the occupation of the premises with persons or organisations providing services ancillary to the services the practice provides under its core contract. This would enable the practice to remain dynamic in responding to patient needs, such as making changes to or adding to the services offered, without lengthy or costly requests for landlord's consent. So you can see that in the context of practices allowing rooms to be used by community midwives, podiatrists or physiotherapists, etc. in this way. Essentially, a practice should consider the flexibility it may need in order to respond to changes in the way it delivers services in the future and to meet those changes in its lease. And the more flexible these arrangements, the more this is going to enable a practice to collaborate more effectively and to play a more active part in its primary care network and possibly to look at merging and other new ways of working. So finally, Victoria, are there any other financial considerations that practices need to bear in mind when entering a lease arrangement?
There are. A practice should bear in mind that there may be SDLT or stamp duty land tax due to HMRC on the grant of the lease. Save for in very limited cases, a tenant must submit a tax return to HMRC on completion of a new lease and pay any associated SDLT due on that transaction. So this is similar to what you would see when purchasing a house, for example. The calculation of SDLT is complicated and it should be done at the outset of the matter so that the practice has an idea of what level, if any, of liability it's facing by entering into the lease. And this can be done using the HMRC's SDLT online calculator, which will give some indication of the amount that could be due. It's worth bearing in mind that where VAT is payable on the rent, the VAT amount is also taxable for the purposes of SDLT. There'll generally be no SDLT due for intra-partner transfers, so when a lease is transferred between incoming and outgoing partners of a GP practice, but care will be needed to ensure that that is a genuine intra-partner transfer. Because it's such a complex area of tax, I would always recommend that practices take specialist accountancy advice in respect of both the lease and their possible liability for SDLT. Worth doing that at the outset. Importantly, where there is an SDLT liability, practices should speak to NHS England or the ICB to inquire whether any financial support is available in respect of that liability in the form of reimbursement.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our first podcast on primary care properties and leases. Thank you very much for joining us. I hope that's given you some helpful tips in terms of understanding why a lease might be needed and the key terms to think about when entering into negotiations with your landlord or with your tenant around the provisions of those leases and the importance of ensuring that you have the right specialist, legal, accountancy and surveying advice. We look forward to welcoming you to further podcasts in this series. Thank you very much to Victoria.
Thanks, Lisa.